What happens when a church locks its doors, boards up the windows, and says only the righteous can enter? Is this the fate of the once mighty Anglican Church in Australia as conservatives flex their muscle?
We need to survive as social groups because that's how we get on in the world. The danger, of course, is self-righteousness. Mm. Yeah. The establishment of your own self as the pure place. Ultimately, you end up with a church of one.
That story's soon. And can the moral dilemmas of war cause as much psychological injury as the combat itself? I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. He preaches, he tweets, he prances, he dances, he even does comedy on the side. But Perth vicar Chris Bedding is now in serious trouble with the Anglican Church, not for any crime, but for his jokes, online and on stage. The popular vicar of St Cuthbert's Church moonlights as a comedian, and his annual satire at the Perth Fringe Festival is called Pirate Church. But Perth's traditionally liberal Anglican leaders say he's blasphemous, and they've suspended him. So what did Father Chris Bedding say to upset the church?
One of my great sins was to question a policy of the diocese, the social media policy, which claims to be binding on all church workers. So that's clergy and church wardens, and even the Sunday school teachers are supposed to abide by it. And I did criticise that publicly and also in private. And I suspect that, and also some statements I made about the resignation of our former Archbishop, have perhaps offended people who hold positions of authority in the diocese.
Yes, you have actually sort of been accused of blasphemy because you do a comedy act on the side every year at the Fringe Festival. But there is a more serious element to this, though, Chris. What did you say about the former Anglican Archbishop of Perth, Roger Herft, who resigned because he admitted failures in the way that he handled sex abuse cases when he was the Bishop of Newcastle?
I said the Most Reverend Roger Herft has resigned as Archbishop of Perth. I believe this was the right decision. I hope that his resignation can have a sacramental quality. I hope that it can be an outward sign of repentance for the way that we, the Church, have collectively failed survivors of abuse. I hope that this can be his final act of ministry as a diocesan bishop to graciously lay down his role and aid the healing of those who have suffered. Mm. And that statement features in the complaint that the Professional Standards Director made against me to the Professional Standards Committee, and clearly that touched a nerve.
It touched a nerve, but I think anyone listening to that statement would accept that it's said in sorrow rather than in anger. It's not mocking at all. I mean, what did they possibly find objectionable about that?
It actually says in the complaint, please explain why you expressed a personal opinion directing a presumption of guilt toward the Archbishop. It seems that there was a concern that I might have suggested in public that the Archbishop was guilty. Now, I don't think I did. And I believe that he actually has admitted and named some of the failings that he made.
Mm. What else did you say that enraged them? Well, really, not them, but a single person, because, as I understand, it is a single complainant.
That's right. The complainant is Tracy Chambers Clark, who is the Director of Professional Standards. And she made the complaint to herself. She then took it to the committee that she's the executive officer of. And she then has been giving them information or, you know, guiding them through this right up to this point of suspension. Another thing that I said in a public comment just on my Facebook page, Father Chris, said in this time of shame, uncertainty and decline for the institutional church, our tendency is to circle the wagons and put our heads down. There's a strong tendency to promote conformity and compliance with the system, and I think that's rubbish. And I stand by what I said, and I wonder if the concern isn't that I've hurt someone, but rather that I've challenged the conformity and compliance culture within our church.
There are things, though, Chris, that you've said that might, to the outsider, to the uninitiated, and to those who are seeking to criticise the church or build on the many criticisms of the church, might look like cheap shots, though, aren't there?
Pirate Church is a work of satire, and we call it a work of loving satire because Wurzel and I, who are Pirate Church, love the church, and we love the Bible, and we really, really love Jesus. And by making people laugh and making people think at the same time, our aim is to help people sort of deepen their faith or deepen their journey of discovery of what faith might look like.
The church is understandably very sensitive about its manifest failures in the sexual abuse crisis. So can you understand, therefore, that they've leapt on what is a light-hearted promotional line of yours where you talk about a kids' church that involves prancing with toddlers? I know it's a play on the words dancing with the stars, but can you understand why they're sensitive about that?
Look, actually, that's the one thing I can understand why someone might be sensitive about. And that was posted on the 25th of July last year. And if there was a concern, I would have hoped that the Professional Standards Director would have picked up the phone straight away and said, look, it's just a bit on edge. Instead, what happened was it took six more months or more before I even knew that it was a concern. And there's been no one in the meantime who's expressed any worry about it.
Yeah, I should just clarify, by the way, that when you use the line prancing with toddlers, it is to promote a regular music event for kids and their parents.
That's right, mainly music. It's run all over the country. It's a fantastic program, and I lead it nearly every week, and I can confirm that I both prance, dance, bounce, and frolic at that event.
Right. What might surprise a lot of people, though, is that you're a liberal Anglican, but you're in a liberal diocese. Perth is noted as a sort of bastion of liberal Anglicanism. So does it surprise you that you're a victim, as it were, of a liberal diocese?
Whatever kind of church context you are in, the possibility for abuse of power is the same. And sadly, yes, I'm a progressive voice in a progressive diocese, but it doesn't change the fact that there are power systems that are clearly quite easy to exploit. My evangelical colleagues in the diocese have been horrified by this situation and quite baffled by the fact that one of the most prominent progressive voices is being attacked by the institutional hierarchy.
Chris, you are part of the sort of Catholic end of the Anglican Church. You have a particular reverence for the style of worship. I'm just wondering, in that case, you don't think it's a bit of a contradiction that on Sundays you're being very reverent in the church, but on Saturday night perhaps you're making fun of the church. You're singing songs like Away Into Danger and Wreck the Halls and A Week and Christmas at St. Bastard's?
I am considered by my congregation an irredeemable conservative. They think I'm so square in the way I conduct liturgy and in, you know, my style of service. It does feel like a contradiction. The great thing about Anglicanism to me, and the reason I've stuck with it, is because we don't take ourselves so seriously, and we can actually laugh about who we are, our idiosyncrasies, our quirks, our strangeness. And people who come to Pirate Church shows usually come away saying, it was great to laugh at who we are, but it's also really exposed what's great about us, the fact that we're just so daggy and so naff, that what binds us together isn't the fact that we're really cool or important or we have high status, but we're actually bound together in Christ.
Suspended Perth vicar and sometime comedian Chris Bedding. Now, the administrator of the Perth Diocese, Bishop Kate Wilmot, has told media the process for standing down Father Bedding was independent and confidential. On the other side of the country, the Conservative Anglicans in Sydney are holding their annual synod. And just like with an insurance policy, you need to read the fine print of the agenda. One document has the obscure title, The Theology of Communion and Catholicity. But it contains what could be the seeds of a split that could end up tearing apart the worldwide church. It emphasises what Sydney Anglican leaders believe is their pure biblical doctrine. It questions the authority of the Archbishop of Canterbury, and it wonders if conservative Anglicans should associate with those who disagree. Professor Stephen Pickard is Executive Director of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture. He's also an Anglican bishop, but an outsider from the Canberra-Goulburn Diocese. How does he read the document?
It maps out what we mean by communion or fellowship together and who belongs. There's very strong emphasis on purity of doctrine and getting right teaching.
Mm, purity of doctrine. We'll come to that in a moment. It looks like the Sydney Anglicans are angry at what they perceive to be the more liberal attitudes of some Anglicans in Australia, but especially in Canada and the United States, about human sexuality. Does it look like they simply don't want to be part of the same church?
People feel very passionately and strongly about their religious convictions, and the question of human sexuality, it's been played out in the Anglican Communion in the last 15 years or so, has been one of those hot-button issues. So it's not surprising, and it actually has caused a lot of division and concern. So from that point of view, this is not new territory. The other thing I'd say, Andrew, is this has to do with identity. And we're all concerned with faithfulness to the identity of our Christian calling. The problem is, what do you do when you have difference? And how do you deal with division and things that you don't agree with? That's the issue. How do we live together in a world where we're increasingly aware that we're much more diverse than we ever might have imagined? And I find it interesting that they say in the social new world of social media, we can misunderstand ourselves more quickly than ever before. And there does have a sense at times that we can differentiate ourselves over against those churches, those groups that we do not agree with. And if actually we're not part of the one body of Christ, that we're simply organizational units in between the local church and the universal church in heaven, then there's not quite as much weight to that fracture or that rupturing as well.
Well, you say the argument, Stephen, is about how we live together, and you are very much involved as the head of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture in trying to work out the role of Christianity in a pluralist Australia. How do you think documents like this, which very much seek to set at least this part of the church off from the rest of the world, what message does that send?
Well, it's not a message that is at the forefront of the work that we undertake. I can tell you, our concern is to look to the horizon of a common humanity and the great issues of the day.
I mean, how do you read a comment like this, Stephen? And this is part of this document from the Sydney Anglicans. When Christians are in communion but not in accord, their relationship will be one of exhortation, debate, and limited cooperation.
Yes, I did read that in the report. I noticed that in that same area, they talked about different levels of being together. And this was the second level of being in debate with each other. The first level was of a mutual mind about things and a consensus. Secondly, debate. And then the third level was a much more severe and strict differentiation from. So there you've got a sort of leveling of the way in which we relate to one another. Sometimes it has to be like this, but it sometimes also sends alarm bells when you think that you see the thing exactly right and others are wrong.
Yeah, it also says this sort of understanding that the Sydney Anglicans believe Anglicans elsewhere in the world have about sexuality. That is, that they may be having a more permissive view of gay sexuality. They say that the impact of this will be rebuke, withdrawal of fellowship, prayer and evangelism. Now, they're very harsh words. How would a non-Christian, the sort of person that your centre is trying to connect with, perceive that kind of language?
We are in a critical situation in relation to Christianity. And what we need to do is to try to make the links and enter into new conversations and be a place of hosting those. So rebuke, differentiation from, separation. I don't know whether this is going to be the horizon that'll win the day for the new generations in the intergenerational work that the Christian faith has to attend to in the new mission.
This sounds rather like the thinking of the former Pope Benedict, who spoke of a smaller, and he was speaking here of his Catholic Church, of course, a smaller but more pure church. Is that the way to go?
There is a wonderful book that I started reading last year called The Righteous Mind, When Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, by a wonderful author, Jonathan Haidt. He takes it from an evolutionary biological point of view and says, look, why do we get so intent on making these separations and divisions? He said, there is one element of it which we mustn't discount, and that is the strong survival instinct. we need to survive as social groups because that's how we get on in the world. But I thought the title was revealing, The Righteous Mind. The whole question about the correct position, the doctrinally pure position, these kind of things at one level, they have something to commend because we do want to be faithful. We do want to be pure. We do want to live in the life of the gospel. On the other hand, our strengths, not only in this but generally in the church and beyond, are also our weaknesses. The danger, of course, is self-righteousness, the establishment of your own self as the pure place. Ultimately, you end up with a church of one.
What would be the consequence if the Sydney Anglican Diocese decided to withdraw from the worldwide Anglican Communion?
Whether the wider communion responds accordingly and says, well, okay, that's how you want it, or continues with the olive leaf and gesture of friendship and communion and say, well, this might be a period which is difficult, but we're not going to accept that that's the final fracture and break. Thank you very much. So they continue the work of fellowship.
It might have impact, though, on the Diocese of Sydney and its assets. I mean, let's come down to nuts and bolts. There have been cases in the United States where more conservative parts of the Episcopal Church have decided to withdraw from what is admittedly a very, very liberal part of the Anglican Church, but they haven't been able to take the churches and the property with them.
That's true. It's very interesting. If you read the Gospels, if you took out all the references to Jesus' comments about wealth and property, there wouldn't often be a great deal left. He had a lot to say about the danger of ownership of property and what that can do. Generally speaking, we're pretty jealous about the things that we have. What that means from an ecclesial point of view these days is that instead of taking your bag and leaving, there seems to be a stronger effort into influence and drawing others into the orbit of your view.
Overall, Stephen, several scholars have suggested to me that this document looks like the first step in justifying something as serious as a schism in the Anglican Church. Is that what it looks like to you?
To the extent that it has a very strong emphasis on orthodox teaching, doctrinal purity, it does have that sense of preparing the ground for some next move. However, there are often usually unintended consequences of things, and people need to be very careful before they take it to the next step.
Professor Stephen Pickard is Executive Director of the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture at Charles Sturt University. He's also an Assistant Anglican Bishop. Thanks for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report, Stephen.
It's my pleasure, Andrew.
And you're with Andrew West. Last week, we brought you a discussion on the ethical debate within the Australian military about the conduct of war. For those living in conflict zones, the costs are obvious. The destruction of lives, homes, communities. For those returning from war, there's post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. But can the moral dilemma about the war you're called to fight be as traumatic as the fighting itself? Psychiatrist Tanveer Ahmed addressed the army recently on this very topic, and in this National Mental Health Week, joined us to discuss it.
It's important that we have a level of fear to threat. Otherwise, we would end up doing stupid or risky things and probably end up getting, you know, eaten by a tiger or whatever else. But often what happens in modern life, those things are excessive and we end up being too avoidant in a whole range of things, most commonly social situations, etc. So post-traumatic stress, hypervigilance leads to an intense, both an irritability, for example, often a lot of my patients, they'll just have ordinary conversations at home and what would have been trivial, like their wife or daughter saying, oh, have you taken the garbage out, will suddenly be perceived as threat. So this is where it really starts impacting upon their day-to-day life.
Yeah, you gave Tanvir a recent speech, very interesting speech, to the army. And you said that the definition, though, of post-traumatic stress disorder has changed. Now, how has it changed?
I think it's really important we talk about the history of post-traumatic stress, because I think it's actually critical to a whole range of discussions we have now in society, particularly around vulnerability, resilience, and there's a lot of politics that goes around that. Now, the military is important for a whole range of reasons in how we envisage things. Because it's such an extreme of the human experience, we often get ideas about human nature from war, and ideas around trauma very much come from war. Now, before 1930, even though we knew about this trauma experience, it might have been called shell shock or war neurosis, right up to 1930, you know, cowardice was a capital punishment then. So it's interesting we don't use the term coward anymore because there's moral connotations. And likewise, 100 years ago, if people faked anything about their war service, it was more likely to be heroism, whereas now it might be a trauma. Now, I just want to go on from there. Back then, it was accepted that people would have some version of what we now call post-traumatic stress, but it was envisaged as more closely related to their own vulnerabilities. So it was seen as something quite rare, and if it did continue those kind of symptoms for more than, say, 6, 12 months, it was understood that it was related to the specific vulnerabilities of the individual. So most people recovered, or it was some sort of post-traumatic growth that could be seen as that. And obviously war had different connotations then as well.
You point out that today we have fewer people on the front lines of combat, but we have higher levels of post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, are we over-diagnosing, or could it simply be the fact that, as you've pointed out, back in the 1920s, men who came back from World War One, well, it's just a bit of shell shock. We didn't take it seriously. What is the situation there?
I think there's more to say about it. I think now we need to talk about how PTSD came in, and it really came out of the Vietnam War, and it was driven a lot by politics, you know, partly from anti-war psychiatrists who saw that there was a large group of alienated, essentially there was an injustice in the Vietnam veteran, and there was all this unjust war. So there was a real push politically, a combination of health, legal, and a host of social groups, that something needed to be done, if you like. And if you look at the initial descriptions, it had less to do with the life-threatening nature of combat than this idea of deception. There's actually a famous New York Times op-ed by a guy called Dr. James Chaitin, and he talks about people being duped and deceived by the government. So it's less about the individual's vulnerability and more about the external trauma. Now, that's a huge difference. What we're really saying...
What do you mean there?
So basically what I was saying earlier, historically, we might have seen it more related to the individual's vulnerability. So it happened rarely and only in specific individuals who already have some kind of psychological vulnerability. What PTSD changed was that it was less about the individual's vulnerability and it was more about this trauma people experience.
You point out in your speech that, you know, soldiers started to think that the moral ambiguity of the conflict was as traumatic as the conflict itself. But the moral ambiguity did lead to terrible things where, for example, we discussed on this program last week the ethics of war, and we reflected on the My Lai massacre where US troops killed 500 villagers, innocent villagers, in a terrible incident in 1968. There were lots of arguments after that about the moral ambiguity because they'd been told to clear villages of anyone they believed was hostile. And so they just went carte blanche. So the two can cross over, can't they? I mean, they're...
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a critical point, Andrew. Now, I think it's worth comparing rates of post-traumatic stress with groups like, say, traditional groups like, say, Native Americans or Amazonian tribes, and also the Israelis. Now, there's very little record anthropologically of what we might call PTSD in Native groups. Likewise, Israel, they have rates less than 1 or 2%. They have amongst the lowest rates in, say, the developed world. And I think it raised some interesting issues. One, the moral legitimacy of that war is very strong because it's right on the doorstep.
Well, whereas what the Israelis perceive as the moral legitimacy.
Yeah. For them. I mean, one measure of a moral legitimacy of war is just how far away it is. So I think there's a growing disconnect between the military and society that I think is a factor here. Now, when I see patients who've often go to war, in many respects, it's the most significant time of their lives. I remember just giving this talk to the armed forces, and it was their health corps. The army is in many ways like a traditional society, very hierarchical, very ritualized. I remember after my talk, there was a big ritual. They gave me this coin. They've got hats and markers and medals. You've got very defined roles. You kind of go together in packs of 30 and 40, like hunter-gatherer groups. And I think often what happens for many of the patients I see, that while it is part about any traumas they experienced in war, but I think it is important to point out the war has never been safer. The vast majority of people coming back did not actually face frontline combat. Now, that's not to say they didn't, you know, have difficult experiences. I think one of the bigger elements is their difficulties in reintegrating back to a very different society.
When you talk about the war never being safer, that leads, though, to another moral ambiguity that we reflected on last week in our discussion of the ethics of war. A drone pilot who is remotely dropping bombs or ordering so-called pinpoint strikes on a target, and he is 5,000 kilometres away, 10,000 kilometres away in a bunker in the US desert. He does feel, though, the trauma, surely, even though he is remotely fighting that war, because there's a much greater moral ambiguity. He wonders...
it's a great question. They actually have, the person firing a drone actually have similar PTSD rates to the people flying the planes. Mm. So your question is right on. But I mean, when you look at the key most traumatic events, the most significant, most painful event is watching having a friend die. But there are all these factors that make you more likely to suffer PTSD. They include being female or having some history of abuse. I think often some people have their own vulnerabilities, feel a really strong sense of identity and purpose in a place like the army, but then their reintegration back to what is basically a post-religious, de-ritualized, highly individualized society is particularly traumatic. And there aren't really structured ways of them to process that experience. So for example, in a lot of native societies, this kind of dramatic retelling of the combat experience, trauma is a group collective experience. It is not in our society.
So in the absence of a society which is increasingly without church, without a sense of fellowship that you get either through, and you mentioned trade unions or local clubs, the sufferer of post-traumatic stress disorder is left to what?
We increasingly lack structures to process adversity and suffering. And this is, you know, it's Mental Health Week. So increasingly, one of the issues around mental health, some of the key reasons of the cultural rise of mental health are as follows. Life's project has shifted to one of individual self-fulfillment. We lack collective structures to deal with distress. We lack moral language to think about adversity, suffering, good, bad. We're highly individualized and we use the language of psychology to make sense of our lives. PTSD increasingly is a structure to process adversity and suffering. When it's handled poorly, it can become a way to strip yourself, a way of kind of going, okay, it's all about the war experience or the car accident, etc. And suddenly it's a way to wash away all these other factors that are often contributing to the problems of their life.
Psychiatrist Tanvir Ahmed, ending today's Religion and Ethics Report, but the debate about military ethics goes on this week on God Forbid with James Carlton this Sunday morning on RN or via the ABC Listen app, which is also where you can find our stories, and we're on iTunes. Thanks to Nadia Delgourley and Joel and Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.